From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunter Killer, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, now available on digital. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda, and produced by Dan Asma, Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister, as Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice. She unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos. Now, Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour, with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and the Unnamed Footage Festival, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed found footage horror film, and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available now on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Prime Video and Apple Plus.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
In each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, I'm very excited because our guest is director Joe Lynch. You know him for films such as Mayhem, Wrong Turn 2, Everly, and most recently, Suitable Flesh. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. This is awesome. I can't wait to open up old wounds, if you will, and pick at all that scar tissue. Ooh. That I've been holding off for so long just for you guys.
Wow. Can't wait. Feel honored. So, I want to talk about Suitable Flesh, though. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about it?
Sure. Suitable Flesh is a provocative neo-noir, noirotica, miskatonic verse homage to the work of Stuart Gordon from back in the day, from movies such as Reanimator and From Beyond. But it's also an homage to a lot of those erotic thrillers from back in the day as well. You know, this is basically me purging a lot of sexual demons that I think a lot of us have, but all through the guise of art. And by art, I mean cinema. And by cinema, I mean Suitable Flesh.
Wow, that perfect.
What else is there to say?
There's a lot to say, but I've had a lot of experience, not just doing, you know, press for the movie, but, you know, like I used to work at a video store and, you know, like so many of us back in the day, remember those things, video stores? And to be able to have to sell, like, you know, if Scream 2 wasn't in and you had to sell Friday the 13th Part 5 or The Prowler, you had to like, so tell me about The Prowler. And then you'd have to go like, okay, well, I can tell them the plot, or I can tell them that, like, you know, Tom Savini did the effects and how awesome they were and Joe Zito directed it and blah, 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 blah. So I try to go for those things that will hopefully make someone go, I will get Friday the 13th Part 5. Thank you, sir. So, you know, I'm trying to apply the same energy to Suitable Flesh. Funny enough, there's going to be a VHS version of Suitable Flesh coming out in the spring, which I'm really excited about. I just finished the pan and scan version that I did with Alex from Broke Horror Fan, where we were literally doing pan and scan version of it in 4:3.
Oh my god!
Just the way that you had to see it. So
that is the way to see it.
Well, I mean, it's been such a hot topic over the past couple months and years about physical media and how we are losing ownership of physical media, because it's so easy to click on iTunes and get that movie for $5.99, and then someday, poof,
it's gone.
Yep.
Your copy of Hot to Trot is gone. And what do you do? You know, so to be able to have as many versions of this movie in physical media, like the Blu-ray for Suitable Flesh just came out last week, and we tried to make it worth everyone's while by putting a lot of special features on it. Obviously, having a VHS version, there's a lot of fans who love that version of, you know, the VHS advent. So the more that we can physically put it into people's hands and hopefully on people's shelves, will mean that it will last longer these days, you know, God willing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, seriously. But okay, so you talked about a kind of an homage to Stuart Gordon and The Reanimator. And it's wild to me that this was, you know, written by Dennis Paoli. Is it Paoli? Is that how you pronounce
Paoli.
His last name?
Yep. It's kind Paoli. Of like, you know, garlic aioli with a P.
There you go. And so what was that like? How did this kind of come together? Was this something that you saw a script for and you were interested in? How did you get to work with Dennis? He's awesome.
This is all thanks, or you can all like place the blame squarely on Barbara Crampton. She was the one who reached out to me with Dennis because, you know, originally this script was going to be directed by Stuart Gordon that Dennis wrote for Stuart back in the day. Oh. This was about like 10 or 12 years ago. They were developing a version of The Thing on the Doorstep, which was, you know, written as an H.P. Lovecraft short story that they adapted into a script called The Thing on the Doorstep. And then unfortunately we lost Stuart in 2020. And, you know, I, like many people are, you know, were huge and still are huge fans of, all of Stuart's contributions to many genres, not just the horror genre, but to sci-fi and to comedy. And there's so many different realms that Stuart had his sticky little hands in, but we lost him and we never got to see his version of The Thing on the Doorstep, which was in a way positioned as a like kind of like the Blues Brothers. They were getting the band back together. It was Stuart and Dennis, right, and Brian Usna. You know, Barbara was involved at some point. I believe Jeffrey Combs was approached as well to kind of bring a little bit of that Miskatonic magic back. And unfortunately, we lost him. But Barbara reached out to me, and this was about 2 months after Stuart had died. And this was in the middle of the pandemic. And I, you know, like many people, I was home probably baking bread or, you know, writing that screenplay that I've always been waiting for because no one can go out at this point. And I got an email from Barbara, and Barbara and I had become friendly over the years at that point. So I wasn't like, whoa, Barbara Crampton just emailed me. That's crazy. It was, right, you know, usually it's been a back and forth, but it had the subject header of The Thing on the Doorstep. And I had had conversations with Stuart at, I think it was one of the Masters of Horror dinners a few years earlier when he was talking about doing this. And I was so excited as a fan. And, you know, when the script got sent to me, it was just take a look at it and see, we would love for you to, you know, consider directing it. That was a lot, man. That was like, that was like a big kind of gut punch. Ooh. Cause I'm like, I was so excited to read it as a fan, but then I was like, what can I do to it? You know, like, what can I do to, you know, to bring this to fruition? And reading the script, I got really excited about the possibilities of being able to do it because I know how much Stuart influenced like my own kind of cinematic fetishes and predilections. So I felt like, you know, not a bad choice, but it was also a script that I felt was a little bit, you know, not out of date, but it felt like it was a little behind the times in how we can present this story in a unique way, in a way that, you know, knowing that Stuart was loved to be a bit of a provocateur, to be able to feel a little bit dangerous the same way that we felt Reanimator and From Beyond and a lot of his other movies were. So, you know, this is all down to Barbara Crampton having a little faith in me. But also, supposedly, the rumor has it was that Barbara asked Stuart who he thought would be good to direct the film. And Stuart knew my work. He had, you know, given me some loving words about Wrong Turn 2 and about Everly. So you know, he supposedly said Joe Lynch. And I was just like, whoa. Wow. Like, even the fact that he even thought of my name. Of course, it was probably about 20 names above me. But hopefully, you know, like after a while, they just kind of whittled down that list and went like, okay, now it's time to ask Joe. And and shockingly, you know, after I read the script and my writing partner and I kind of came up with the idea of flipping the genders, but doing it in a way that didn't feel, you know, just like emptily progressive, but do it in a way that felt like thematically this made sense and something that, I mean, I felt like we just hadn't seen enough of, which was eroticism in films that star, you know, older women, you know, because, you know, older women can be sexy too, I'd say. And shockingly, when I wrote that email back and sent it along with like an 8-page thesis on how we felt this would, no, seriously, I still have the document. It was 8 pages long.
Wow.
And, oh my God.
But I pushed send on it going, they are definitely going to say no. I'm going back to bacon bread. And lo and behold, the next day I got an email from Dennis, and you know, Dennis didn't weigh in at all at this point until that reply. And he's like, this is a great idea. Let me get back to you. And 3 weeks later, we got the next draft of the script. And he had not just gone into Final Cut and just changed Edward to Elizabeth and Daniel to Daniela. He really dug his claws into, you know, the bones of this script and, nice. You know, changed it in a way that felt right. It felt very much like something that Stewart would do, but also gave us, you know, ample opportunity to be able to mold it to the cast and mold it to the times and make it feel both relevant and also something throwback, but at the same time be something a little bit dangerous and provocative.
It's funny because when I started watching the movie, I didn't know who wrote it, but I was sitting down, I was watching it, and I was like, man, this does feel like a Stuart Gordon movie in terms of like an homage to the kind of films that I grew up watching from the mm-hmm. Reanimator, etc. And so I watching that and then finding out that it was written by Dennis, I was like, holy shit, this really is like a continuation of the kinds of movies that I would have sought out as a youngster. But also, I do love, as you mentioned, the fact that we have Heather Graham and we have Barbara Crampton's national treasure, but like yep. older women being sexy and being provocative and doing things that it doesn't feel exploitive towards them. And so that's another thing that I appreciated, was that it's eroticized, which we need more erotic in movies. I miss the 90s with the erotic thriller. Give us more of that. So yep. like It's just kismet.
It felt like the perfect movie at the perfect time when we had the opportunity. Barbara, who started producing, you know, a couple of years ago, she had the kind of pull and the kind of power that she could support a movie like this. You know, originally, not many people know this, but she was not supposed to be in the movie. She was only going to produce it. She had started working with this company, AMP, that produced and also did movies that she was in, like Jacob's Ladder. No, not Jacob's Ladder. Jacob's Wife. Jacob's I wish wife. It was Jacob's Ladder.
Can you imagine?
Jacob's Ladder's Wife. Now that's a movie that would scar people for life.
There you go.
But she'd also produced Glorious, the movie Glorious that Rebecca McKendry directed.
Oh, that's right. So,
you know, she was really enjoying, you know, she could do her acting jobs, but she could also be very involved in a great way, in a very creative way on the producing side. She did that. You know, she told me right up front when we did the switch, she's like, I don't want to be in it. And I was like, is that because of the material? She's like, no, I want to be here to support you. And then we started getting the cast. And I think she got a little bit of FOMO from that. She's like, Heather and Dennis and Judah and Jonathan, all in the same, man, I want to be in this movie. And, you know, so it was like an organic way of her falling into the movie, so to speak. That said, she brought, like, I had worked with Barbara on Creepshow before, so I was, you know, already a fan, but watching her work in Creepshow on a essentially a short 23 minute short that was shot in 3 days, watching that woman work, she is a powerhouse. She's so nice to everybody on set. You know, she's very respectful to the collaborative process. She also comes incredibly prepared. She's ready to strike at any moment, you know, and she was amazing to work with. So when we were talking about it, I didn't want to push her to it, but, and plus, to be totally honest, like, I was a little skeptical on like two blondes in the leads. Like, I don't want them to aesthetically look similar, you know, cause originally the part was written for an African-American woman. And you know, not just again to check off a box, but we wanted to, you know, just kind of make it reflective of the times that we live in, or we've always lived in, that other movies just haven't really represented before. But when the idea of having Heather and Barbara in that padded cell, you know, kind of going tête-à-tête to each other, I got so excited. I'm like, this could really be exciting for a lot of people for many reasons. And, you know, but she was the one who was like, I want to do it. Is it, you know, would it be cool if I did it? I'm like, let me think. Yes. Absolutely.
And she just rips that vape. We talked about this at Fantastic Fest. I just love how she rips the vape that hold the whole movie. Just Barbara Crampton.
She got very method with that vape. Like, we were going back and forth. What flavors should I do? What do you think is the most cinematic? Do you think I should go with the strawberry twist, or do you think the green apple would be the right way to go? I'm like, Barbara, it's all the same plumes of smoke. It does not matter. But she went, because she's not a smoker at all. But she was like, I agree. Like, there's times in movies when you can see people smoking and you go, that person has never smoked in their life. They're just starting it now, and it just looks so fake.
We talked about this, too.
Yep.
And every single time now I see someone smoking on screen, I think about that conversation we had. And I try, and I'm like, it's so true. You can totally tell if someone has never smoked before.
There's so many movies that you can just tell. And Barbara didn't want that. She wanted to make sure that when she's ripping clouds, even when she was saying, like, look at that cloud. I really ripped that cloud, didn't I? I'm like, oh my God, she's turning into a hipster. Oh Christ. But she
my
21-year-old really
brother, my trash line cook brother. He's 21.
He gets it. He'd probably watch it and go, like, that lady rips clouds like a motherfucker. God bless her. God bless her. So yeah, no, she's fully committed, you know, on both sides of the screen, you know, but, and she was also my biggest champion, you know, when I wanted to bring in, you know, this particular, you know, my editor and, you know, my writing partner into the fold. She was totally supportive of that, you know, on set. One of the best things that she could have ever said, and I don't know if this is just wanton psychology or, you know, just kind of, you know, director coercion 101, but the night before we started shooting, and at this point, you know, we're in Mississippi, we're ready to rock, you know, with whatever happens, happens at this point. You just kind of have to go with the flow and trust the process, if you will. But Barbara called me up and she goes, look, I know how much Stuart meant to you and you know how much he meant to me. And we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Stuart, obviously, you know, and you've been so good with trying to make this as close to a Stuart Gordon movie as you possibly have. And I could not appreciate that more. All that said, it's time to make this a Joe Lynch film too. And like, I remember being in my Airbnb looking at this dumb fucking picture. You know how like the Airbnbs, they have like all that crappy art that, you know, no one would ever put up on the wall, but staged art. I remember looking at this staged art of a goddamn bird and almost bursting into tears going, I've been officially passed the baton in the best way possible. Cause I, you know, I was nervous. I didn't want to screw this up. Like, right. I know I have my own very particular style, and I wanted to make sure that was also translating well enough to present Stuart's vision, but also my own to this unique story. Like, I always think back to when Spielberg did AI, and as you know, I love Kubrick. I also love Spielberg. I am not the biggest fan of AI because I feel like something got lost in translation when Spielberg was trying to do Kubrick and ended up not feeling like Kubrick at all. And yet it also didn't feel like a Spielberg movie. Right. So there's trappings that you can fall into when you're trying to pay homage too much to another filmmaker, to another style, to another, you know, genre of films, you know, subgenre, if you will. So it was a very delicate balancing act that I had to do every single day in prep, in production, and in post to ensure that for all of you Stuart Gordon fans out there, myself included, we were satisfying and tipping our hat in the right ways. But at the same time, you know, be able to satisfy all of my own cinematic fetishes because I have many that are not very Stuart Gordon-esque. I mean, I can look at this movie and go, this is me just basically blowing Brian De Palma for two, you know, for an hour and a half with all the split diopters and,
funky shots.
I had to do it, you know, because I love Brian De Palma just as much as I love Stuart Gordon. And there are certain stylistic tics that, you know, a lot of the influences on this movie were movies like Dress to Kill and Body Double and Blowout. And using some of the language from those movies felt very much like I was, you know, respecting that subgenre as well. So, you know, it was a really very, very difficult balancing act to be able to pull off. But, you know, in certain cases, I feel like I think we pulled it off.
Oh, yeah.
I would agree. 100%.
I would agree. Yeah. Well, okay. So let's start getting into your childhood. Let's talk about the movie you brought today. Joe, what movie did you bring with you today for us to discuss?
So knowing the show and knowing the, you know, like what the crux of this show is and how much cinema has, scarred me for life, so much so that obviously I am a glutton for punishment so much that I got into the business that scarred me for life, I guess. You know, there was a lot of movies that I thought would be perfect for this. You know, some of the runners up were movies because, you know, like when I was growing up as a kid, I thought, well, as a kid, I haven't had sex yet. I haven't smoked a joint yet. So at least until I'm 16 or 17, I am good to go because I'm not a potential victim in a slasher movie. But then I saw movies like Maximum Overdrive and what was it, Silver Bullet, where there are kids who get murdered in that movie. And I remember going, oh shit, all bets are off. Well, maybe if I'm a dog, I'm fine. Then I saw Revenge, Tony Scott's Revenge. I'm like, well, there, fuck. Well, dogs die too in that. I'm screwed. But those movies aside, I tried to think of a movie that came into my life at a perfect moment in time, very much like Reanimator, which is another movie that in one form or another scarred me in the best way for life. But a movie that like kind of changed my DNA and gave me very wildly different ideas of genitalia at the time, I guess you could say. And we'll get into that in a moment. But a movie that really kind of affected me so much that it still has a ripple effect today, and that is Dan O'Bannon's The Return of the Living Dead.
Hell yeah. We are revisiting Return of the Living Dead, everybody. In this film, when two bumbling employees at a medical supply warehouse accidentally release a deadly gas into the air, the vapors cause the dead to rise again as zombies hungry for
brains.
All right, so Joe.
You kind of mentioned that this is like that this came at the perfect time and kind of changed your way of thinking of movies, it sounded like. So how old were you when you saw this? How did you see this? What about this made this your Scarred for Life pick?
So I was, let's see, I was 10 when this movie was released on VHS. Okay. It came out in the theaters when I was 9. I was not allowed to see it. But when the poster came out, I don't know if you guys remember the poster, but it was the punk rock zombies all in the graveyard. And there was something about that poster that fucked me up when I saw it in the marquee at the mom and pop video store. I was like, I was genuinely terrified by that, the images on that poster. Now they're almost graffiti-esque in mm-hmm. art quality, you know, in style. Mm-hmm. They look like somebody tagged a wall with zombies. And there's even a graffitied like version of the zombie writing on a tombstone too. So it's very much, playing in the world of punk. And to be honest, like when I was growing up as a kid, the punk era was considered scary. Like you would see movies and they would make fun of punks, you know, like in, I don't know, fucking European Vacation, they would have like the guys with the mohawks and polka dot hair and everything, and the piercings from the nose to the ear. There was something
changed.
between that and American Werewolf in London had punks in it too, and they were always presented as like, you want to go to the other side of the street when those fuckers are walking down the street. So when I'm seeing this movie and like the poster for this movie, I'm like, wait, zombies, which I was always terrified of because my first movie as a kid was at the age of 3. My very first movie was Dawn of the Dead that my mom took me to go see.
Holy shit.
In the theater. At 3. She couldn't find a babysitter. And the poster said, there is no sex in this film. She's like, well, all right. That was all the convincing I needed. So I remember being in the theater seeing Dawn of the Dead. And I was terrified of zombies. And I had just seen Day of the Dead at that point. And that was like one of those Fangoria movies because I was really very much into Fangoria at this point. And that movie reignited my terror for zombies and how they could, you know, put you in a corner and slowly descend on you. And you are fucked at that point. Sometimes I almost wish that I was a teenager because if Jason's coming after you, there's an element of screaming, there's an element of running, and then there's a slashing, and then you're done. Then you can kind of move on with your death, I guess. But with zombies, they are not only going to corner you, but they are going to rip you apart and they're going to eat you slowly. And you're likely going to be like, choke on them. And it's a terrible, dreadful affair. Return of the Living Dead seemed to promise the same thing in the poster. What I didn't expect was arguably my first taste of a true splatterpunk movie. And by splatterpunk, I mean those like almost horror comedies that came out in the mid 80s that started to blend the idea of horror and comedy kind of coexisting in the same story. You know, I had not seen Evil Dead 2 yet. I had not seen Reanimator yet. Friday the 13th Part 4, which I also consider a splatterpunk movie of sorts, because there is an element of humor to that movie. But those movies had not been in my life yet. Return of the Living Dead was the first time that I truly remember questioning myself, going, am I supposed to laugh or cry or scream? Because some of the images in this are absolutely terrifying, yet the movie's almost telling me it's okay to laugh at it because it's so absurd. You know, everything from a naked corpse running around with its dong hanging out, trying to kill everybody, and you cut the body down by the neck and it's still screaming. I'll never, ever forget there's one shot in that movie where it's a close up of the bald corpse's head with the pitchfork, the pickaxe in its head. And it's just kind of going,
yeah,
I still to this day cannot get that image out of my head. And when you watch it back, it's only 2 seconds long, but those two seconds, man, oof.
But I'm glad you brought that up, because on this rewatch, it really jumped out at me, because I think that moment kind of coalesces what this whole movie is about, because it's kind of humorous, but at the same time, when that pickaxe goes in his head, he's screaming. The body is feeling that pain. And so it's like,
I can hear the scream right now.
Ugh. Yeah. So not only is it like a zombie movie and you're supposed to be feeling terrified for them, but you're feeling terrified, but kind of sad for them as well, because like he's screaming, and that kind of continues throughout the rest of the movie, particularly with the half cut up woman that like is talking about the pain and how they eat the brains for like that. There's so many moments.
That moment in particular, there is a sense of dread and sadness and heartbreak that, again, I was just not ready for what O'Bannon was ready to serve me, because, you know, you can look at so many moments from this movie and go like, do you want a party? Yes, I do want a party. It is party time. You know, you have skeletons coming out of the ground, and you can even see the wires that are, you know, motioning the mechanism of the mouth. So it's a little tongue sticking out of cheek, and you're going, why does that skeleton have eyeballs? Or why are the zombies talking? And where's rigor mortis invested in this entire thing? They even talk about rigor mortis in the movie, and yet these things are running down the street like they're Olympic sprinters. So, you know, there's that element, but then there are moments that are genuinely, you do have empathy for the dead, that there is a pain factor involved. Before, and I think part of that is because O'Bannon created these new rules that we had never instilled in the zombie mythos before. You know, before there is a moment in time before George Romero kind of recalibrated the zombie genre. Yeah. You know, there was the Val Lewton era where zombieism was more based on voodoo. But more cases than not, you very rarely saw them speak. The only other time that I can remember past that would be like Wes Craven's Serpent in the Rainbow, where there was a very fine line between life and death. But in most cases, you know, before George Romero, there was the zombies that were based in voodoo. And then when Romero reinvigorated the zombie genre with Night of the Living Dead, there was a silent menace and a silent terror to them. They couldn't speak. They could barely move, but they could eat. And it was all like basically like motor functions, just a reminder of the past and that insatiable hunger for flesh. Then Dan O'Bannon came in and rewrote the rules again, even though he is hearkening back and referencing Romero's Night of the Living Dead, which was a very shrewd little, you know, marketing tool, if you will, because they needed the rights from John Russo. So, you know, here it is. They're even referencing that old movie, but they've now evolved and developed the zombies that they can run fast. So before, when you were like, well, zombies, no problem, I can just outrun them and get the fuck out of Dodge. Now they're running right behind you. This is years before 28 Days Later started, you know, kind of took the reins and ran with it. Dan O'Bannon was going, fuck rigor mortis. Let's have them run fast. But he also made them speak. And by doing that, by allowing zombies, you know, to consensually speak to their victims, their potential victims, it also gave them a soapbox and a mouthpiece to describe the pains of being dead. And that woman that half woman on that slab, that was actually done by Tony Gardner, who, you know, went on to do the blob.
So good.
He's the guy underneath, is one of his first gigs. And he's the guy that's underneath the gurney, or like that steel slab. And he's the one who's like operating her, even down to that fucking spine that's moving around, that's dripping that viscous, like clear liquid.
That spine, that's like a tail. So
and it's good. And it's dripping because you're expecting it to be, you know, blood or maybe dark viscous goo, not clear spinal fluid. And again, yeah. I was like, whoa, that's too much for me. Something about that fucking shot of the spinal fluid that messed me up. But it was, even though like it doesn't make a lot of sense that like the mouth is gesticulating and mouthing in a way where you're going, well, she kind of needs lips for mouthing bees and stuff. All that aside. But when she says like the reason why that they are eating brains is to essentially push down the, you know, or satisfy the pain of being dead. I mean, I never felt more heartbreak for an inanimate object in my life until that moment.
Existential dread there.
Yes. It, again, not what I was expecting. Because again, you know, my mom would rent all these movies, and as long as they didn't have sex in the movie, she was totally fine with it. If it had copious amounts of gore, she would just go, oh, just go to, you know, go to issue 13 of Fangoria, and they have a whole thing about all the effects in that movie. So you can see how the, you know, how the sausage was made. She was very respectful and responsible in that form. She's probably just making sure that, you know, like if they ever said like, what mother would show the kid that movie? She's like, yeah, but I showed him how it was done. You know, it's totally fine. But, you know, she had never seen the movie either. And she rented it one day and we watched it. I watched it with my brothers. We watched it during the day. I remember the first time watching it was after school, got all my homework done. And I was like, all right, here we go. Let's watch this movie with zombies, expecting something Romero-like. And then I found out that, well, zombies can run fast. So I'm fucked there. They want to eat my brains. Well, there's not much up there to begin with. So maybe I'm all right. But it was more of the idea that they spoke and that there was a pain involved. It made me terrified of death. Not that anyone should not, you know, not be at least fearful of their, you know, their time off this mortal coil. But there was something where I'm like, wow, man, death really sucks. And I'm going to come back as one of those things. Shit.
And be in eternal pain.
And exactly. And then now I got to eat brains. I was not a big brains fan to begin with. Like, I, you know, like there's some people that enjoy, you know, sheep's brains or whatever. Not a fan. The texture, not so much. This was something where I'm like, if that's my only dietary, you know, like, I guess availability, I am fucked, man.
I'm fucked.
Like, can I go with chicken? I'll be more than happy to eat, you know, a shoulder or an arm, if that's going to be a little more on the chicken side of the palate. But brains, right. No, not my thing. Not your thing.
So I wanted to go back to the poster, because I was born in 81, and this movie, this poster was all over the Blockbusters or the, you know, the local mom and pop stores. Like, this poster, I remember specifically seeing this one and Return of the Living Dead Part 2, because that poster itself is also really stunning in a different way. But like these posters, I would stare at it going, what is this movie? And my parents wouldn't let me watch it. And I remember it's so funny, because the cultural impact that this movie has with Simpsons, because my first introduction to zombies talking was the Simpsons episode where the zombies come alive and they're going brains, and they kind of tap on Homer's head and realize he doesn't have any brains. And so then they go looking for brains somewhere else. And I saw that and I was like, oh, zombies can talk. And I didn't even know that it was kind of referencing this movie. And this movie established pretty much that zombies eat brains. Like, this is
there's whole generations post Return of the Living Dead where their go-to for zombie steaks is the fact that they will eat your brains.
Yep.
Before that, it was, well, the whole body is on the menu, it's, you know, but here they have a very particular palate and a very particular diet. And now anytime someone says brains, you know exactly what movie they're talking about. Or no, you might not even know exactly what movie they're talking about, but you know they're talking about zombies. And that's because of this movie. No, nowhere in any other film before were they that specific of a dietary requirement until this movie. And that, like, the fact that he was able to change the game like that. And you know, to go back to the poster again, you look at the poster, that poster is not indicative of the look of the zombies in the movie.
No.
So I remember the first time watching going, where's the cool punk zombies? And I see punks there, but, and then they're eventually going to turn into zombies. But I thought they were, I didn't know that they were just going to be these, you know, muddy gray messes. But again, that kind of made it even scarier. The versions on the poster were almost too comedic in a way. They were like kind of cool. Whereas this horde of zombies in, you know, in the way that it's presented in Urbana's version are ruthless and menacing and fast, and they do not negotiate at all. If anything, they're negotiating for more paramedics or more cops.
Paramedics.
Oh my god.
Favorite moment when I first saw this movie as a teenager, it was like that moment, and I was dying laughing. And then to follow it up with the send more cops. These such a great iconic line.
It's interesting too, because I've been talking a lot about horror comedy, and you know, one of the things that's difficult with horror comedy is the oscillation of stakes, if you will, not to sound all literal here, but you know, when you're dealing with horror and comedy, you know, someone falling down a well in a comedy is absolutely hilarious the way that you present it. Change up the music, or maybe change up the coverage, or even change up how you care about that character. And falling down a well is a fucking traumatic experience on a level of like, you know, like a Danny Boyle movie of some sort. You know, like you're going to feel the pain there. And you're going to, if you care about the character, you're going to feel the dread of loss and what that must feel like. So, you know, certain movies make it easier or hard to recognize those stakes. You know, like I was just talking about Shaun of the Dead and how fucking funny that movie is. But it never lets you forget the stakes to the point when, when mom is about to die, or even that asshole friend in the glasses who you hated the rest of the movie, and now he's getting ripped apart. You genuinely feel for him. So you know, movies like that, you know, and I even think like in terms of Return of the Living Dead, you get to spend enough time with so many of the characters that when they start dropping out of the picture, you're starting to feel a real sense of loss, and you start to miss them. And you don't get that with every horror comedy. You know, I think it's incredibly difficult to be able to find that balance between allowing the audience and letting them know that you're allowed to laugh, maybe at the absurdity of a situation, or maybe like a recent example would be like Josh Rubin's Werewolves Within, where if you turn the sound off on that movie looks terrifying. And it looks like the stakes are really high. And they are. Turn the volume up, and the people that are in the film just so happen to be really funny. And maybe their defense mechanism in these situations, especially Sam Richardson's character, is to almost diffuse the tension by trying to make them, you know, make the other people laugh or make himself laugh too, or just the reactions that he has are really funny in a very nervous, awkward, almost office sort of way. So, you know, it takes a very particular touch to be able to, you know, bring horror comedy in a way that is effective. And Return of the Living Dead, again, they're never making fun of the fact that you will possibly die horribly in this movie. There are certain things that happen, and there are certain kind of absurd moments, like send more cops, like that zombie's just looking to, you know, get his nut. And by nut, I mean brains. Yeah, exactly. He wants a taste of the good life again. You know, just because it's absurd and because he said it. And I think because we're so used to zombies not talking, you go, oh, that's fucking hilarious. But that movie, like Return of the Living Dead, never forgets that the dread and the terror of what's on the other side of that door, or what's on the other side of that wall, or what's lurking in the the graveyard that late at night. So,
yeah.
Well, and I think something that stuck out to me a lot was this view is Linnea Quigley's character Trash, who we all obviously know because she gets naked and likes to dance and get naked. But the thing that really stuck out to me was she talks about like how the biggest thing she's afraid of is getting devoured by men and not being able to get up.
By dirty old men.
And what happens? She gets devoured by dirty old men and becomes a zombie herself. And while I do love a good moment of her being fully naked, standing in front of that unhoused gentleman, and him being like, what is going on here?
Oh, hey, there's everybody, trash is getting naked again. I love the fact that they say again.
Again. It's like, there's like that little bit of tragedy to her character when you hear that about, like, you know, I know that this is not like a deep movie by any means, but, you know, there's a tragedy to Trash's character about, like, oh, she's going to get naked. Oh, and her fear, her biggest fear is being devoured by creepy old men. And she gets devoured by creepy old men. And I just think that's sad for Trash.
I completely agree with you. Like, I think Trash is a tragic character, you know, like the fact that she even says, but in a way she says it in, like, when she talks about those, you know, that men and they're clawing at her and stuff, there's something almost sexual about it. And
that very erotic.
Yeah.
It's very erotic, but it's almost as if the movie is using that trope as like a comeuppance for her, like, be careful what you wish for and you got it. But
yeah,
more interestingly, like, again, you know, I'm at a very susceptible age. I am just starting to understand sexuality in films and the human body and the human form. I snuck a few of my dad's Playboys and Hustlers, so I knew what to expect when it came to nippleage and the undercarriage, if you will. But at the time, and this is in the 80s, I thought that, you know, having hair down there and, you know, a certain amount of foliage was the norm.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden there's that, there's the part when she takes off her clothes and there is nothing there. That was the first time that I had ever seen a bald batch, if you will.
You've seen a fully waxed vein.
But here's the thing, on VHS and even on Laserdisc, you didn't have the full definition of the image that was presented for you.
Sure didn't.
And even, when I would see it in theaters, I saw it a couple times in theaters before I had seen it on Blu-ray, you know, it was clear enough to know there is no bush, you know, so Booger from Revenge of the Nerds would not be happy at all. There's no bush. But in subsequent versions and on... and in interviews, I didn't even know this, but an executive was supposedly so offended by her vagina being shaved. And that was at, I believe, at Dan O'Bannon's request. So whatever Dan O'Bannon was thinking at the time, well, have at it. But he was so appalled by this, you know, very shorn vagina that they actually had to make a crotch patch for her. And you don't see it until you watch it now in 4K or in Blu-ray. If you look very closely, there's no labia. There's no labia whatsoever. Pardon my French, but there is no axe wound in that area whatsoever.
Because I thought it was crazy, because especially when she's walking up to the homeless guy, I'm like, that is not her actual vagina. Like, that is, there's no lips. I'm sorry.
There's nothing.
She looks like a Barbie.
It's exactly. She looks like a fucking Barbie doll. So for the longest time, I was, first off, scarred for life, because I thought, like, what's wrong with her? Where is her vagina? Because there is no bush here. I don't see, there's no bearded clam whatsoever. There's just a clam. But I don't even see the clam. There's just a Barbie patch. If you look very closely, not that I ever look very closely at all. No, not me, not one bit. I didn't press my face up against the screen at all. If you look very closely in that shot when she's walking towards the homeless guy, you can actually see where the seams. This is one of the problems with high definition at this point.
Yes. Right? Because
every version of a movie that you loved in like the 70s and 80s that was using practical effects, the filmmakers, especially the makeup effects artists, knew that there was a certain amount of grain that could hide the seams. Now you can watch something like Flash Gordon, which looked amazing on film back in the 80s. It looks terrible now because you can see where the makeup effects artist stopped, or where the thin line that was showing that was holding the spaceship that was traversing through the air. That's all very visible. And, you know, when you look at something like Return of the Living Dead, which is one of those movies that benefits from the popularity and the cult following that it's attained over the years, enough where they're going to keep remastering it. And the version that's out on streaming and that's in, you know, it's out on Blu-ray now, looks pristine. It looks,
it's too
gorgeous.
Old, too pristine.
But too pristine. And now you're starting to see where the patch ends in a way. But again, for the longest time, I had a new perspective on the neither on a female's genitalia because of this movie. I had never seen anything like that before. I've seen a few since, thankfully. But up until that point, man, I had a very particular perspective on not just the female body, but also sexuality. I never had, and again, I was 10 at the time, but you know, being a 10-year-old, you can appreciate certain forms of boobies, erotica, if you will, when you're a young boy.
I'll tell you, one of the things that this generation is going to miss out on is forest porn. I don't know if this is ever something that anyone else has experienced, but in Alaska, I lived in Alaska as a kid, and you would walk through the forest. And I remember a couple times finding parts of a Playboy, like just pages that were torn out in the forest. And that was my first encounter with sexuality, was finding what I call forest porn. And I don't think people are going to have that anymore.
There's a discoverability that means that you have to go out into the Alaskan forest to find erotica. Whereas now, hold on.
Boopity boop, 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 boop. Yep, there it is.
My 9-year-old can go online and look at the most salacious, disgusting porn possible. Like, I have been asked, what's fisting, Dad? Guarantee you that person, that young child did not walk into the woods one day and go like, fisting. No, they got it off the fucking internet. But I agree. Like the amount of because I definitely am one of the generation that discovered sexuality through media, you know, through film and through TV, yep, through video, through music in certain forms. But for the visualization of sexuality, was very much kind of cultivated for me, at least, through media and through these different forms of media like TV and film. And the way that it's presented in Return of the Living Dead, thanks to Linnea Quigley, who obviously was a source for my desire in many a film like Night of the Demons and Savage Streets, but especially in Return of the Living Dead, it was the first time that I can remember that way. A beautiful woman was presented as a zombie, and I didn't know whether to run or to drop my pants and masturbate. I had no clue what to do at that point. So I was very confused at that point over what, especially that moment when she comes out of the of the fog, and it's got that music. Like, the only other time that I could think of at that point was maybe Fright Night. But you know, that, but in a way, Fright Night kind of presented it in a very queer form, which, you know, like, I wasn't attuned to my sexuality at that point. So I didn't know what was, you know, like what team I played on, so to speak. My mom did. Mm-hmm. And my mom sure knew what team she played on, because all she talked about was fucking Chris Sarandon and his goddamn sweater that whole time. That goddamn sweater. But
she didn't know I was gay as a kid with that sweater. I'm telling you.
Let's just say that I see Fright Night in a very different way now than I did back at this as a kid. Back as a kid, you know, I was kind of almost told, like, look, you're a straight boy. You got to like women. You like boobies and vaginas. And that's it. You know, now things are different. But, you know, back then it was, okay, this is how it's presented. And in a lot of ways, it was usually those movies that played on Cinemax, you know, at 8 o'clock, or the movies that played after 8 on HBO. And I knew where those were coming from, but here it was presented in a way that, like, again, I just wasn't sure how to feel. And that's a good thing. I think, you know, like it almost challenges the audience to identify themselves and what their fetishes are by doing it in a way that almost teeters the line between, you know, adoration and seduction and threat. And there's many times in Return of the Living Dead that does that, thanks to Linnea Quigley and her goddamn crotch patch.
What I also love about Trash, though, is she's so contrarian. Like, the dialogue where, like, someone says that this building is a hideous, ugly place, and she's like, I like it. It's a statement. Or,
yeah. I think it's a statement. Oh, shit.
Or, like, where they're talking about the cemetery, and like, oh, the cemetery. And she's like, ooh, let's do that. Or where she's trying to, like, seduce suicide, which is one of my favorite moments, because she is going hard for suicide. And he's like, this is not just a costume. This is a way of life. And talking about spooky, and she's like, I like it spooky. And he's just completely ignoring her, but she's being contrarian about everything. And I love that. I love that character.
But I think, I mean, to be honest, Trash is definitely one of my favorite characters of the movie, because she, I feel like she's someone who's going through a phase in her life, and she's not quite sure of her identity at that point, yeah. You know, because you're right. Like, you know, she's using sexuality to, you know, to make a statement, to be seen, if anything. You know, she's saying all these things where it's like, oh, I think it's sexy. Like, even the way that she talks, it feels like she is almost testing the waters of her. But like, she's trying to test the waters of her own identity. And weirdly enough, her truest self comes out after she's dead. And I think that there's something really powerful about that. I think that there's something that is really exciting over the fact that she is contrarian until she hits the afterlife. And then she is the most, again, you look at those scenes when she is walking down, you know, down that that alleyway, you've never seen that character more self-assured of herself.
Yeah.
Before that, she's jumping from character to character, almost testing each of them to see, like, are we compatible? Are we compatible? Can we hang out? Like, when she talks to Suicide, she's grabbing his dick. Like, he completely ignores her. And you can almost see her going like, maybe this is not my guy, you know, or maybe this is not the someone that I want to, you know, kind of hang out with more. It's only until she becomes part of the afterlife and she finds her kind of her most naked self and her truest self that she seems so confident when she's walking down that alleyway. And anytime that you see her since, she is feral. She is so confident. And that's what makes her almost in the best way possible. That's what makes her so sexy, but also so terrifying too.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, that she's got the best, I think she's got one of the best arcs in the whole movie.
Yeah. And I think it's like contrasted with like a foil with Freddy, who is slowly dying throughout the entire movie and turning into like a scared child. So like, there's her path of finding herself through becoming a zombie, and we have Freddy, who is like, the rigor mortis is setting in, his back is all bruised because he's been laying there, and it's just like seeing him go through the stages of death, like through the entire film, who I thought when I first watched it was going to be like the protagonist, the hero of the movie, and he's not. He turns into the villain by the end. It's such interesting kind of framing there.
Yeah, this was 3 years before, two or three years before I had seen the movie that really changed my life, which was Chuck Russell's The Blob. That movie made me want to be a filmmaker, but that's a whole nother episode.
Perfect movie.
I remember seeing it, 3 p.m. show, August 7th, 1988. Changed my life forever. That's the moment where I went, oh, that's what a director does. I want to do that. Before that, I wanted to be Tom Savini. I either wanted to be an actor or a makeup effects artist or both. And that was Tom Savini to me. But with the way that Freddy is presented, the reason why I brought up The Blob was because I thought Donovan Leitch was going to be the hero, and then joink, he's definitely not. Same thing. I thought, you know, he and James Caan were going to be the heroes of the movie, and they end up becoming, you know, foils and then ultimately antagonists. I wasn't expecting that. So again, another kind of scarring moment for me was that here's a movie that's positioning itself with one protagonist, and then it rips the carpet out from underneath you. I can't trust this movie. I can't trust that this movie is going to present me with reliable narrators, if you will, or reliable protagonists, because they're going to fucking die, or worse, they're going to go after our heroes. And that again, that terrified me. That instilled mistrust into people around me in the best way possible, because, you know, no one should be trusted. But like, at this point, the movie is saying, here's your heroes. We're spending a lot of time with them in the beginning, and then all of a sudden they are gone, or worse, they are dead. And they are now going to turn, slowly but surely, they are going to turn into your worst nightmare. And, you know, and to go into like the climax of the movie, again, this is an important one for me. I don't remember a movie up to that point that had such so bleak an ending, because in most cases, we're going into movies with the safety of knowing that by the time you get to the end credits, something's going to be resolved. There is likely, we all grew up with, you know, children's stories of dot, 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 ellipses, and they lived happily ever after. And here's a movie that brings you to the brink of hope and then drops a bomb. Literally drops a bomb, not just on you, but on everybody. And that it's image.
No, it's just another connection to The Blob too, because in The Blob, when the military and the scientists come, that you think, oh, they're going to save the day, they're actually there for nefarious purposes. And here we have the government trying to, you know, silence their problem that they has been lingering for decades that they want to finally get rid of. And so they're OK with blowing up 20 blocks of Louisville, Kentucky, just to solve their problem. It's such a nihilistic ending in a decade that I think is typically seen as being kind of popcorn and over the top. We still have these very nihilistic moments in this and in The Blob, too.
But it was also tapping into the fears that we had because we were still in the throes of the Cold War and that nuclear threat was imminent. So, you know, movies like The Blob, you know, where you couldn't necessarily trust the government or they'll just drop a bomb on you, or Return of the Living Dead, which has this nightmare image of the bomb dropping and you see the mushroom cloud in the distance, but you see all the houses in the foreground that look like my house, that look like my neighbor's house, that look like the houses that you saw on Amazing Stories, that Spielberg show that was, you know, fetishizing suburban life. You know, that's what we grew up in. We grew up in a Spielberg world where everything was a cul-de-sac and every house looked the same. And all our problems are always solved by the end of the movie. And then those houses are fucking blown away. And I remember watching at that moment. And I will never forget this because I remember sitting there and my mom going, "All right, who's ready for Denny's?" You know, no, it was Friendly's. We're all going to go to Friendly's afterwards because we're East Coast. And I remember sitting there going, "There is no God. We're all gonna die." Like, I had never been presented with a movie that was positioning itself as even movies as bleak as, say, like Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead. There were still happy endings. There was still hope. There were still survivors. And this movie was saying, "Oh no, the only survivors that are going to get out of this are the fucking douchebag, you know, military guys that are all the way out in Malibu who are pushing the button. But suburban life, middle class America, you're all getting laid to waste. That you're all fucked." And that really made me start to rethink how movies and how stories visually could be presented to an audience, and that you don't always have to have a happy ending. You don't always have to have a button. You know, this movie does have a slight button, and I think they were very smart in recontextualizing the final song, the "Do You Want a Party" song, and then using like a montage of all your favorite moments, because they didn't want the audience to walk out feeling fucking devastated like they just watched Schindler's List. You know, they wanted you to walk out going like, "Hey, that was a party. It is
that
party.
That was party. Time. That was fun."
But Jesus Christ, all right, man, am I glad to get out of that fucking house? Let's go make our own party elsewhere. The idea that O'Bannon was able to get away with as bleak a fucking ending and to show that there was no hope changed the way I saw movies, changed the way that I was like up for telling stories. Like I would go to sleepovers and tell scary stories, you know, and there'd always be the button, but I would always go further and be like, you know, and then the boogeyman got out and then he murdered them all. And he took them out into the edge of the road and dumped them off the side like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, and then drove off and then went to a hamburger joint. And then I was coming up with the bleakest shit. And everyone
you
at that
really
point
popular,
was like,
huh?
"You
were really
no, I was popular. Nope. Let's just say that after a couple sleepovers, I was not invited again. but I love how this movie, you know, comes across as a party movie, as a whooping good time, but it doesn't forget that it is there to fucking damage you. And O'Bannon, you know, was a person who was, you know, afflicted by, I believe it was Crohn's disease.
Crohn's,
you know, he was in constant pain all the time. And, you know, I really truly think that he himself, if there was any character that he related to the most, it was that half woman corpse on that slab. And the fact that like every gesticulation that corpse made was almost like a reflection of how he felt every time he moved, and how, you know, he was just looking for his version of brains to make the pain go away. You know, there were interviews with him where he would even like kind of half jokingly say like, "I wish I was dead sometimes." But I think there was some truth to that too. And this was a film that, you know, in one form or another was very cathartic for him. And I'm glad he got it out. But Jesus Christ, man, did that like that literally, and I'm going to tag the moment that movie literally scarred me for life.
And on that note, let's wrap this up and give us a rating out of 5. Wow, what a good transition, Joe. It's almost like you podcast.
I try my best. Well, who's going to go first?
So Terry's up first. Terry, how many brains out of five do you give Return of the Living Dead?
This movie is a fucking classic. Dan O'Bannon, I don't think gets enough credit for what he brings to the, what he brought to the horror world.
I agree with that.
Alien scarred me for life. That was one of my scarred for life moments of a movie that I stopped watching with my parents because I couldn't handle it anymore. Dead and Buried, fantastic.
Such a good movie.
So fucking good. So smart, so iconic, and such a cultural impact that this movie has had on the zombie genre since then. It's great. It has that sense of humor, but it also is enough darkness in there to be kind of a dark comedy in spots. And then it's also kind of terrifying. And the questions that it's asking with the existential feeling of being in pain while you're dead is just, it's perfect. This movie is a perfect movie for me. It's one of the rare movies that I can unabashedly say is a five brains movie. I love this movie so much. Every single time I watch it, it's like a comfort watch for me. What about you, Mary Beth? Because you saw it for the first time for our last recording, right? Wasn't that when you first saw it?
I didn't grow up with this movie. But I loved it when I first saw it. And I gave it a 4 on Letterboxd. I looked today and when I first saw it, but I think I'm gonna bump it up to 5 brains, because upon watching it again and just catching things I didn't before and realizing how smart it is and nihilistic and important it is, and for all the reasons we talked about, and also just imprinting that image of the corpse saying that brains are what keeps us from feeling the pain of death, like, it's just so smart and so good and changed zombies. And I just, one day we will have our version of this, I guess, kind of 28 days later, but maybe we'll get a different version again, but who knows? Yeah, 5 brains for me. And Joe, you have the final word. How many brains do you give?
Whole episode has been me flating this movie. So I'm not going to throw out I'm thinking like 2.5 brains, you know,
okay.
This is one of those films that, like I said before, it changed the way I saw movies, the way I saw horror films, the way I saw zombie movies, the way I saw death, the way I saw genitals. It was a very pivotal film in my upbringing, both as a film lover, a film fan, and as a human being, and as a future corpse. it's one of those movies that I can put on. You know, everybody watches it either during Halloween or they watch it on July 3rd because the Chiron in the beginning says July 3rd. So it's kind of a 4th of July movie, if you will, very patriotic film. But this is a movie there's one of those few films that I could put it on every day if I wanted to and not be bored by it. And I can also, every time I watch it, I always find something new. It's not like something that, like, you know, when you hear about filmmakers, you know, like Kubrick, for example, where you go like, oh, you should go back and look at the cans in The Shining. He spent 4 weeks on those cans, like in the very particular position where they had to be. No, like I doubt that he was really thinking about those cans, but we interpret that the artist was so confident in their craft that they were thinking about those fucking cans. But there are things that I see every time I watch it that I'd never seen before, or I reevaluate, or this is one of those great like litmus test movies that like I love to show people who have never seen it before and get their reaction out of it. Last year, my wife's sister from England, she came to visit us and she had never seen it before. And we're like, oh, ho, ho, ho. So we showed it to her and she's not a horror fan, but she fucking loved it so much so that the second she got home, she bought a copy of it. And every time she watches it, she sends us the Chiron of July 3rd. And there were things in it that she was picking out that I had never seen before. Like, I think it was like, it wasn't the butterflies in the background in the beginning of the movie when they're in the, when they're in the warehouse. There was another detail in the background that I had never seen before. I'm like, how did I fucking miss that? But she brought a whole new perspective of it. This is just one of those perfect genre movies that is, I feel, a great gateway movie to not just being able to appreciate horror comedy, the splatter era, Dan O'Bannon's work, but it also allows you to realize that, you know, genre comes in many forms, and Return of the Living Dead may have been, you know, a cash grab for some, and a frivolous kind of effort in the work of horror for others. But I feel like this is truly one of the masterful films of the 80s that took everything in the culture at that point, threw it in a pot, turned it up to boil, stirred the shit out of it, and then dumps it on your head in the best way possible. And yeah, it is, to me, it is a perfect film front to back from the beginning to the end. This gets 6 brains out of 5. I'm going over the quota, and easily one of my favorite films of all time, and one of the films that would, that got me where I am today.
I also want to throw out, kind of going on with this changing life and kind of the idea of being alive and dead, there was a quote from Dan O'Bannon on making his directorial debut with this movie: I spent 37 years of my life not being alive. Now I'm fulfilled.
And you can feel it. You can honestly feel, I mean, he only made a few films after this. Funny enough, he did a Lovecraft adaptation with Chris Sarandon, I think in like 1990, The Resurrected. And I don't think that he's ever made anything both on the page or on screen that has quite the same resonance. I know that, you know, for years, from the time that this movie came out until about 2001 or 2002, when the DVD, the first special edition DVD came out. Fun fact, when I first came out here to LA, I had just moved out with my now ex and my brother. And, we came from New York. And I was like, holy shit, I'm in Hollywood. Holy crap, it's first day. I don't know if you guys are familiar with LA at all, but on the there's the 405 freeway that connects kind of everything. And driving up the 405 freeway, and out of the blue, my brother goes, hey, do you know that the new version of Return of the Living Dead just came out on DVD? I literally drove 5 lanes from left to right, screeching, kind of like French Connection. I French Connectioned, like, and almost caused like 4 or 5 accidents just to get off on the off exit to go to the Sherman Oaks Galleria where they shot Commando and Fast Times at Ridgemont High. But more fun facts there. To go to the, I believe it was the Tower Record that was there at the time, because I had to, without fail, get that fucking copy of Return of the Living Dead. I put the car in park. I put the hazard lights on. I said, give me 2 minutes. I run upstairs. I find the copy. I'm running down again. And I literally bump into Guillermo del Toro. He just happened to be there because he was in the office next door doing Hellboy at the time. And he was just reading comics at the time. And I was just so like, oh my God, I fucking love Hollywood. I just found a copy of Return of the Living Dead at a Tower Records in the same mall that they shot from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And I literally just bumped into one of my favorite directors. Who knew?
Best day ever.
So honestly, that was like the first, because of Return of the Living Dead coming out on DVD that day and me being in Hollywood at that time, that's how I got to meet del Toro for the first time. And he kind of mentored me for a couple of years. You know, like when I was first starting out, he's the guy that got me Spectral Motion when I was doing Knights of Badassdom. So thanks to Return of the Living Dead, it kind of kickstarted my feature career in one form or another. So thank you, Dan O'Bannon, from beyond the grave. You know, I have a lot to pay homage to Return of the Living Dead. And you know, I think that's one of the movies that I can, that's in my DNA in a way, in terms of the kind of movies that I love, the kind of movies I like to make, you know, those movies that kind of teeter the line between, horror and comedy, movies that are fun, but never forget the stakes, because death is the ultimate stake. And this is a movie that like plays with those, you know, those tropes, but never lets you forget that we are all going to die and eat brains someday.
Yep. Hell yeah.
There you go. That's all I got. I'm done. Now all I want to do is go home and watch Return of the Living Dead again. I watch it again for this. And it's just one of those movies I can just put on anytime. And I hope that I'm watching it with someone new, because I get excited just watching them see it. Have you guys ever seen it in a theater?
No, I have not.
I desperately
highly
want to.
Recommended. Highly recommended. It is one of those, it is a perfect audience reaction movie, especially now. Like, I'm sure back in 85 when it first came out, you know, I think, you know, if you go to like Times Square or a Grindhouse or something like that back in the day, I'm sure there was a lot of hooting and hollering. But you know, if you go to someplace like you know, the New Beverly in LA or the Metrograph in New York or any repertory theater, if they're ever playing Return of the Living Dead, I know the Alamo Drafthouse plays it usually during Halloween. They'll usually have some of their branches. Trust me, if you're listening to this, do yourself a favor. Go see Return of the Living Dead in a theater with a crowd, preferably sneak in a few beers or, you know, maybe get a couple drinks from the draft house and enjoy yourself, because this movie is like the ultimate horror party movie.
Ah, well, thank you so much, Joe, for joining us. And just this film is so important. So thank you so much. Where can our listeners find you? And the floor is yours to plug away with what you can talk about.
Well, if you want to hear and see me talk about movies and more movies and probably my own movies, I am on social media at the Joe Lynch on Instagram and Twitter, or X, or whatever the fuck they're calling it these days. More importantly, it'll always be Twitter to us. More importantly, I am on Letterboxd. That's my favorite social media platform. I've been on it since 2012. And, you know, I mainly use it to just log the movies so I can remember, like, oh yeah, I just watched Werewolves Within. What did I think about that? Or, oh, I saw Mother, the Aronofsky's Mother, because you have to say it like that with the exclamation point. I saw that a couple of years ago. What did I think about that? I love Letterboxd because it truly is a way, more as a tool for me to remember, because I am getting old and my brains are not like working at full capacity anymore. So it's good to have a resource to be able to go like, oh, this is what I watched like last year. I can confidently say that I logged 584 films last year. You know, I know that thanks to Letterboxd. But it's also a good way to get recommendations from, you know, other like-minded sickos like myself and other people that I follow. I like to recommend anytime, you know, look, I am not a critic, but I do like to reflect on the movies that I've seen. I don't like to poo-poo movies, even if it's a movie that I don't like. I like to, you know, kind of think. I don't like to punch down. I like to punch up. And even if there's, you know, things in a movie that I don't like, I'll, you know, go, but, you know, the cinematography was great. You know, like, because I think that it's good to have a dialogue, even if it ends up being me talking about Caddyshack 2 and it ends up being a monologue instead of a dialogue. At least I'm getting the word out there for someone to go, maybe I should give Caddyshack 2 a try. So if you really want to follow me and see all the movies that I'm usually watching, like tonight when I go home and I watch Truly Madly Deeply, the Alan Rickman ghost romance movie, follow
Hell
me
yeah.
on
better.
Follow me on Letterboxd at the Joe Lynch. And
I just followed you.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, you did. Hey, look at that. Suitable Flesh is out now on Blu-ray. Depending on when this drops, it will be out on Shudder January 26th. It will also be on VHS in the spring. There might be something else coming up with it very soon. I don't want to give too much away, but I'm not done with Suitable Flesh just yet, let's just say. But it is also out on VOD. So you have no excuse anymore to not see Suitable Flesh wherever you can watch movies.
All right, listeners, so you heard from us. We want to hear from you. What was your experience with Return of the Living Dead? Send us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us directly on social media. I'm at MB McAndrews on Twitter and at MB.McAndrews on Instagram.
And I'm at Gaily Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, don't forget to follow the podcast on Twitter and Blue Sky at Scarred Podcast and on Instagram at Scarred for Life Podcast.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you want to help support us, we do have a Patreon.
Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there, but most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.